coming to the thing that is
if we on and we welcome to the other many participants and it can yet.
Yeah, no, we love Tashan. We do Tashan once a week.
Delica? Hey, Rivera.
I just wanted to know if you can hear me. I know we're waiting still for the others. I just wanted to make sure. Thanks.
Yes, you're audible. Thank you.
Goeiemiddag, waar's die mense? Waar's die mense?
from my week, it's just hard for everyone else that's on there to know why we are waiting to start in that
Hulle is nog besig om na Cyril se stikken stories te luister.
Hallo Mr. Paulson.
Hallo Annelie, how are you?
I'm well and you? It's actually great hearing the well-known voices again of this
And yeah, it was very boring without this.
I
Yeah, I'm tired of just fighting with EFF members. I want to fight with other political parties.
You want to fight with everyone.
Life is one beautiful struggle. Beautiful struggle.
That's right. This is in the mind of the beholder, so I believe you.
Dumelang bagolo.
Kitchen, dumelang.
Dumelang.
Ke fona wena outside.
Dumelang slalo.
Hey, kunjani?
Siphilile.
Hey, nong philile nam.
Lekhai.
Rde ligai da.
Rating. Look,
So that's
we must hurry. We've got an election to win.
And I'm not going to share it.
You'll see how you can.
May I request that I am told that there are some of the colleagues who are still traveling to the parks. I'm not too sure how much time do they need. Dumela Chileka?
Yes, Chawen.
Good job.
Happy Lagunjan.
Akondo, akondo.
Passing us long, Che.
Eh?
But they were passing Athlone, when was it? I think 3 minutes ago. But we do have the required quorum. So I think we can just do
you
the
process. Check with them. I don't know where it's Athlone. Good evening, Honorable Bryant.
Evening, Chair. I just want to say I support Tileka's suggestion that we start and they can join if we are Corat, because we've got a lot of people presenting and some people who are not officials, just out of courtesy to them. Just the suggestion. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Paulson, good to see you. You're muted.
Good evening, Chair. I said I like your kafir. I'm wearing the official the Palestinian soccer jersey.
Hey, we really
miss this bank. This bank once existed. This bank once existed. It was bombed and they stole the money.
Honorable Weber, good evening to you.
Recording in progress.
Sarichi, good evening. It's a very warm welcome to you. So happy and a happy 2024 to everyone. Happy
Yay.
To be back.
Baie dankie, Lennery, vir jou ook. Alle voorspoed in die jaar wat voor lê.
Else is here. It's Honorable Dlamini here.
Not yet, sir.
Honorable Gancho.
Not yet.
Honorable
Mama Mankunu.
Not yet, Ravlish.
I say training, sir. She's in the meeting.
Oh, so one of Mankunu?
Good afternoon.
Good job.
Happy New Year. Ngiyaphila Chairperson, wenu njani?
Ngiyaphila. Welcome. Happy New Year to you. Umambata?
Not yet, John Chair.
Minister Chris, is she here?
I received an apology from Minister NTM. DG will also join us later, Jen.
The DG is also not here yet. She's coming.
Yeah, she's finishing a meeting, but will join later on, Jen.
Who's leading the team here?
I think it's Vanessa.
Is she here? Ms.
But
Brenda,
remember, they are not presenting, Jen.
Yeah, no. But just saying, in case there are issues that they need to take note of.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. So do we have a quorum?
We do, Chair.
Ngabobani Chile. Ngu Bryant, Ngu Paulson, Ngu Mchunu, Baba Tatuka.
By five, Chair. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Ngubano?
Dieter, yourself, Brian, Paulson, and Mchunu.
Angubali mna kwezo zinto, chini?
Ya vota kaloku, sisi zo vota chini.
Yey, ase vota yapa. Hey, wabuyo ke energy na.
Chair, there's load shedding at 8.
Oh, okay. But did you check them?
Yes, I asked Lungas to update me.
But then Honorable Bryant has proposed that we should proceed and then they will join us on the way. They could be in the bus, so it might be a very bit difficult for them to hear.
Yes.
Okay. Can you kindly fly to the agenda? I think we must start and with an understanding or hope that the colleagues who are still traveling to the villages will join us. I think I just also saw Honorable Winkler. She could also be in the same path. Let me take this opportunity to officially welcome you all to our first meeting of 2024. I hope that we all had a wonderful rest. And I know that our schedule is rather busy and hectic while in election mood and election year. But work still needs to be done. My name is Ntibi Mutise. I have not changed. The whole year this year, I'm going to use that name. The briefing I have is that the team will be led by the Director General, who is also going to join us later. But I got information that Ms. Mokhoshoa is here. Ms. Mokhoshoa, are you here? Ms. Mokhoshoa, are you here? Okay, not here yet. Ms. Benderman,
yes,
are you here?
Yes, sir, I am here.
Come on, give me Ms. Mokhoshoa.
Yes.
Oh, Dumela, welcome.
Melam,
thank you.
I am here, Chair, Ms. Benderman.
Thank you. Good evening to you and welcome. Ms. Tankosi, is he here?
Yes, Chair, I'm here. and good evening.
Good evening. Welcome.
Thank you.
Ms. Nchanga.
Good evening, Chair. Indeed, I'm here. Thank you.
Wonderful. Welcome. Mr. Matibe. Mr. Matibe is here. Mr. Walters.
Good evening, Chair. I can hear you loud and clear.
Great. Welcome. Good evening to you. Ms. Khubela, is she here?
Yes, Chair. Good evening.
Thobela.
Ahentat.
Ms. Mpulukeng.
Good evening, Chair. Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Ramukhela Thobela. Thank you. Ms. Lepogole.
Good evening, Chair. I'm here.
Great. Welcome. Mr. Nyama.
Good evening. Thanks, Chair. I'm here in the meeting. Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Nyama. Mr. Mguni, good evening to you. Gift. And now you want to be called by your name.
Hi, Chair. Sorry. It's Nicolio Ansinis. Mr. Mguni is having issues with signal. He's at a PCO office. He says he's trying to join.
Leon Sinis, how are you?
Togeda Mohen.
All right.
Good day.
Great. Ms. Hani, good evening to you. Happy 2024. Not here. Ms. Mbogoto.
Good evening, Chair. I'm here.
Great. Welcome. Is the CEO of SunParks here?
Yes, I'm here.
Legai me.
Tsena ka ntate.
No re aphela, ngwa go mosha.
Tsale bo ntate, le ho wena ntate. Thank you.
Mr. Mokoena. Property.
Good evening, Chair. I'm here and compliments of the new year.
Happy new year to you too, ntate. Re leboga. Dr. Hendricks.
Good evening, Chair. I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mtimkulu.
Good evening, Chair. I'm here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Welcome to all of you. All the best in 2024. Do we have registered apologies just for the record, Chilega?
Chair, you forgot to welcome the presenters.
Dr. Mahume, Dr. Mahume, yeah?
He is Dr. Chair. Mahume. I will allow him to introduce himself.
Is he here? Or she?
He. Yes, he.
Okay. Dr. Little, good evening.
Good evening. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. The representative of the Leopard Trust, who's representing the Cape Leopard Trust?
It's myself, Chair, Helen Turnbull, and my colleague, Katie Williams.
Good evening to the two of you. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. I think we should then proceed. Let's put those apologies on record, Ms. Madubela.
Yes, Chair, can we adopt the agenda, please?
No, can we get the apologies?
Oh, okay. Chair, apologies from Minister City.
Okay.
Honorable Soju, Deputy Minister, and the DG Chair, as I said it earlier. And obviously the members that are still traveling to the villages. They said they will be at home, Chair, around 6:30.
Okay, do we have anything from Honorable Singh?
He accepted the invite, but I have not heard from him.
Okay, please be kind to check him after when you have adopted the agenda. I'm sure it's human to forget. Okay, colleagues, may I get a mover of the adoption of the agenda? Honorable Mkunu?
Thank you, Chairperson. I move that we adopt the agenda.
Okay, there's a proposal that we adopt this agenda as it is for today. Can you have a seconder? Thank you very much, Honorable Weber. I wanted to check, Chileka, that was it not possible for us to move that item of the adoption of the program, given the fact that there's also going to be load shedding at some point. That is, if it's allowed, if members are at, if there's an agreement. Good evening, Honorable Weber. Welcome to the meeting. Are you in already?
I'm here, Chair.
And Winkler, Chair.
Honorable Winkler, I'm sorry. I wanted to say Winkler.
Yes.
Welcome,
good evening, Winkler. Everyone. So lovely to see you all in the new year.
Good to see you. So I'm putting a proposal there that we remove that item because we might be having a problem of an agenda of load shedding, and we don't want to limit time for our visitors and members. Can I propose that we then go straight to the presentations, and then in our next meeting next week, we'll then adopt the program that will guide our way going forward. So one about Baba Kapa.
So one a chair.
Right, sir.
The right chair right now?
No, the right one can go motion.
Now you can share your screen. So entire screen, you click on entire screen, say share, and then you go to purple.
But now they are allowing it.
That's what I'm saying.
Are you able to minimize it?
Yeah.
And then If I press it, it will come
up. Let me stop sharing.
Chair, have we started the presentation?
Yes.
What's going on? Chairperson, Honorable Chair, I think there is a challenge for it, Honorable Members. I can't hear the Chair. I can only see Mr.
You're on mute.
Uyangi, can you hear me now?
Yes, can hear you now.
Can you also see me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay, Honorable Brian, you were asking if we are going straight to presentation.
No, Chair, I think Mr. Mangume was getting his presentation up and running and it came up by mistake, but it seems like it's sorted now.
Oh, okay. In fact, it's time. Dr. Mangume, let's invite you to make a presentation on behalf of the Provincial Game Reserves. Welcome, let's proceed.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir, we can hear you. Good evening, Honorable Singh. Welcome.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. Sorry, I'm a bit late.
No problem. Just about time for the first presentation. Happy New Year to you, too.
Same to you. Thank you, and all the colleagues.
Dr. Makhume, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Good evening to Portfolio Committee members. Good evening to you, Chair. And good evening to the invitees in the meeting. I'm Hector Makhume. I have been in conservation ever since I came out of university in 1986. So I have not done any other job formally by waking up and going to report in the workplace other than nature conservation. So that should just help committee members a little bit. Otherwise, I have a doctorate in biodiversity management from the University of Kent in the UK. But otherwise, I was educated here in South Africa, schooled in the landscapes of South Africa, and trained here. So I think it's an area that I know very well. Currently, I am a member and director of WESA, Wildlife and Environment Society of South Africa. And I'm going to share with the committee some of the work that was done by WESA together with the Endangered Wildlife Trust on the state of nature conservation in our provincial reserves. I think just to help the members. More than that, I have myself served on two provincial conservation bodies, the Northwest Province and Mpumalanga Parks and Northwest Parks. I have served there as a member of the board and particularly holding the portfolio of chairperson of conservation. So that's roughly about me, Chair, and I'll then get into the presentation. I have there that nature conservation is 90% managing people and 10% managing the resources. The challenge that we have with nature conservation is people and nothing more than that. If we leave nature to be by itself and there were no people interfering with it, we would not be having problems. Therefore, our challenge is and always will be to manage people. And I think that is what the heart of this presentation is going to be about. I do have a quotation from one of the gurus of nature conservation, Aldo Leupold, who says, "We abuse land because we see it as a commodity belonging to us. But when we see land as a commodity to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and with respect." The topic that we are talking about tonight, the difficulty with it is that we see parks. When we go to parks, we don't see parks every day when we drive in our provinces to work and went anywhere else. So it is as if it is something that for us to see, we have to go there, and if we don't get there, we don't see it. And as such, Chair, it is very difficult for many South Africans who have not been to parks and to nature reserves to relate to what we talk about when we say there are problems with management. And it becomes an issue of what are you really talking about, because they don't see these things. When we talk about the problem with Eskom, when we talk about the problem with state-managed hospitals, people can relate to that because they do go there and they have experiences. But when it comes to nature conservation, it's people mostly who are working in the parks and those that frequent our parks that can relate to some of the things that we share. I'm just sharing that slide to show that in most cases when we talk about problems in parks and in nature reserves, we use iconic species to highlight the problem. And there it is the problem of poaching in our parks, and we have their rhinos. And I am arguing here, Chair, that I think we put too much focus on dead rhinos. We put too much focus on poaching and other things, whereas actually the most important thing is the basic resource upon which our rhinos, our elephants, and our other animals, our biodiversity in South Africa, depend. How the soils are managed, or how the soils look like, how the entire landscape is managed, how the entire landscape looks like. So I think the focus should always be there, or should also be there, more than just on looking at the dead animals and how we can, and what we can do about them. The Endangered Wildlife Trust and WESA put out a report last year. So Chair, we are looking at the most recent report on the state of conservation in the provincial parks. The report is available, if people Google it, it's available online. Those that do not have access to the report and would like to get it, I can share. I'm also certain that Dr. Howard Hendricks has got access to the same report that he can actually share if people are not able to get hold of me. The state of provincial reserves in South Africa, challenges and recommendations. I'm just sharing about five slides because I would like members of the committee to ask questions than me giving a whole lecture and people who've had a long day, I then lose them somewhere. There are three key challenges that have been highlighted. One is budget, lack of money. The other one is capacity, skills, lack of qualified people to manage the resources, and lack or poor management of the resources. And for me, those three are about the highlight of it. I'm not the rest, political interference, resources, how to motivate staff. I think those are the facts of life and those will always be with us. The bottom line, Chairperson, is that 80% of the budget in the provinces, except South African National Parks, is used for salaries and staff-related costs. 20% or 15% only goes to the actual management of the parks. This problem has been with the provincial reserves, many of them, since 1994. The situation is just worsening. I'm not raising anything new there. The exception with certain parks is that they generate close to about 80% or 85% or 75% of their own money to manage the parks. Bottom line, money is needed to manage parks properly, nothing more, nothing less. Lack of capacity is total lack of conservation knowledge. But when we say lack of capacity here, senior staff that are appointed that have got little understanding of the key conservation issues and the management of the parks in the reserves. So we're not talking about senior people that are at the executive level. Parks are managed by technical staff that are park wardens, that are ecologists in the field, that are field managers in the reserves. Those are the people that I am talking about here. I am not talking about the chief executive or a chief financial officer. I'm talking about the people that actually have got the responsibility to manage the resource. Frequently mentioned opportunities to address, they are again related, that we need to skill our staff, we need to have collaborations, and we need to find additional funding options. We cannot be asking the state to come up with all the solutions for the problems that we have. We need partnerships. We can tell the state, we can't tell the state who to hire, but we can work with the state closely, NGOs, NPCs. That is what we are suggesting here. And we can let go of protected areas that make little contribution to biodiversity conservation. Some of the protected areas that we have, Chair, were set aside at a time when we knew little about biodiversity, what it is, what areas are critical to conserve, and what areas should we bring into the portfolio. By the way, South Africa ranks among the 5 or 10 mega diverse countries, along with Chile and Brazil and other countries that are known to be high in biodiversity. And that is what is important to protect, bottom line, biodiversity more than any other thing. The interventions that we believe are needed for desired states, and if we look at lessons elsewhere, for South Africa, most of our parks are fenced off. And therefore, the idea of community-based natural resources in South Africa, it has got little footing and little appeal, because historically, the local people have been isolated from parks through fences. And for whatever reasons, by the way, the fences work well in terms of keeping wildlife, in terms of reducing conflict. So models that we see in Namibia that work well, and elsewhere, in South Africa, we have problems to import them because our landscape and our history is not such that our own disenfranchised people live with resources. They don't, in most cases, live with the resource. By resources, I mean wildlife. They don't live with elephants. They don't live with rhinos. There may be areas where people are living with few impalas and few kudus, elsewhere in the northwest, elsewhere in KZN, elsewhere in Limpopo. But those are far in between. What do we think we need in this situation where we have problems like we have? The challenge, and I'm saying this boldly, Chair, and I'm sticking my neck out, I am putting forward that in future, we may be speaking only of South African national parks, the parks that they manage, and perhaps Cape Nature, because they have different challenges, and they have historically been able to retain a pool of qualified staff, but they don't have problems with rhinos and elephants and other things. So over time, we may have a major problems. I am putting forward here provocatively that provincial parks without good tourism income will totally collapse. We will come to a point where they are no longer there. They are what we call paper parks. There could be hope for some provincial parks that I'm directly involved with, like Madikwe and Pilanesberg, because of strong private sector tourism concessions, where they are able to generate money, and they are able to use some of the money to put into conserving these areas. Some provinces are keen to have the African Parks model. The African Parks model, Chair, is basically a model where non-profit agency, the African Parks, has gone around few areas in Africa and have actually said to park to government, we can take paper parks, these parks that exist on paper, but in real life, when you go there, there is nothing, and turn them around. And there is no doubt now, I was one of the skeptics and one of the people that did not believe in their model. But having worked in Malawi and having worked in Zambia and elsewhere, I have seen African parks turn around parks that were hopeless and pathetic to areas beaming with wildlife. And some provinces that I have worked with, namely Mpumalanga and Northwest Parks, they are keen to have people other than the state to assist them to manage their areas better. The protected areas allows for co-management of protected areas, and it also allows for other persons other than those that are state officers to manage protected areas. So our legislation also allows for co-management. It also allows for the MEC or for the minister to appoint, I'll just give you an example, to appoint Endangered Wildlife Trust. Not that I'm vouching for them here, they have not even asked for that. Or WESA to go and manage a particular place, let's say Pilanesberg. Our law allows for that. So I just wanted to say, if we are looking for solutions, we don't have to go and rewrite the conservation books. Our laws allow for that. So I think that brings me to the end of my presentation. Chair, I would rather take questions than continue talking. The state will not provide sustainable funding. It is already failing to fund key social and economic functions. It is our reality. It is not the reality only in South Africa. It is the reality throughout Africa. Time is against us. Our status as a mega diverse country is at risk. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Makgome. Honorable members, what would we prefer, to have another presentation or engage Mr. Makgome, Paul, Honorable Paulson? I see your hand.
Thank you very much, JJ. I was going to ask a question, but I didn't know you were going to ask whether we must engage now. So if we can engage now, ask the question now. If not, I can ask it later.
Okay, maybe we should then take questions for Mr. Makgome. Please proceed, Honorable Ponson.
Thank you very much, JJ. The only question I want to ask Mr. Makgome is, many of the protected areas present nothing unique about the area, but especially like areas like in the Western Cape, for example, in order to keep people from accessing land, suddenly, you know, and I know several areas, Radial and Leswick Park of the M5, that are considered protected areas, but it's only to prevent people from accessing land, and they fence it off. It has no purpose. Sometimes it's just wild grass there and some of those tiger lilies, but nothing really special about it, other than to just exclude people from accessing land that they have every right to access. So I want to know from Mr. Makgome, you know, because I don't see this. There's no other province in this country where you are landless and you are denied access land to build your mkuku or anything, right? It's only in the Western Cape where there's the highest prevalence of protected areas to deny indigenous people access to land. And I want to know, what can people do to reverse this protected area status in order to access land? Because it's been abused to further oppress and keep people landless. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Paulson. Honorable Bryant, you'll be followed by Honorable Weber, Honorable Winkler, and Honorable Singh.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and thank you, Dr. McGormier, for that presentation. I think some very, very important insights, and I think all of us will definitely make an effort to go and read up on the documentation that you mentioned at the beginning of your presentation to supplement our understanding. And I think, as you mentioned, biodiversity is such an important part of our tourism offering, and also such an important part of what makes our South African environment so unique. And it's so important for us to ensure that we protect that biodiversity. And I think, as mentioned, the Western Cape is definitely setting an extremely good example in terms of protecting our biodiversity as one of the most biodiverse regions in the world. I've just got two questions. The first one is, you have mentioned Cape Nature along with Sandbox as potentially two of the only entities that may still be functioning in a few years' time when it comes to parks. What is it, in your opinion, that sets Cape Nature apart from some of these other provincial facilities? For instance, we've had a presentation from the Northwest Parks Board and Tourism Board, which actually doesn't even exist anymore, which was in charge when 51 rhino horns were stolen right from under their noses just a few months back. We've seen the multiple issues that are going on there. I just want to find out from you, in terms of Cape Nature, why is this still functioning quite well? I know you mentioned rhinos and the pressures that come with having to manage rhinos when it comes to poaching, but those three key areas, those challenges you identified: budget, capacity, mismanagement, etc. What is it that Cape Nature has managed to do differently in the face of those challenges? And then I think one of the most important aspects is, how do we make these reserves financially sustainable going forward? It's not just about providing the budget into a black hole, so to speak, but rather ensuring that these reserves are able to sustain themselves through really viable tourism offerings. What are some of the suggestions that you would have, or some of the things that you've picked up during your own investigations and experience as to what makes a provincial reserve work from a financial sustainability perspective? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Brian.
Thank you, Chair. Can I speak?
Yes, Honorable Weber.
Yeah, I also have a couple of questions. I think the first question is, Dr. Mokami, is that 80% of the budget is quite a lot.
Honorable Weber, please hold on.
Okay.
There is someone whose mic is unmuted.
It's mine. I'm in a busy place. Let me move.
Oh, is it yours?
It is better. It's mine.
Much better, yes. Proceed.
Okay, that's much better. All right. Okay, I think the one thing that really is a great concern is the 80% of the budget that goes for salaries and staff, which leaves 20% for the resources for everything that needs to be able to run a provincial park or any park. And that is very, very little money. So I do understand the need for private investments and NGOs and things like that. But the more concern of this 80% of the budget is where you said that the people appointed actually knows very little about conservation. And then in the same breath, you also said that you have no impact and you cannot tell the state to tell them who to fill the positions with. So my question is, as the chairperson of two important, very important boards, surely the board can request that a surrender appetite that is qualified people, that is people, whether it's internship and anything like that, that it is in conservation. And that should be in the criteria when one advertises for these positions. So these people need to have at least a qualification, not necessarily a doctor's degree, but some kind of training and diploma or something in conservation. And that must be a must, because otherwise appointing people, you can't do anything with. Now, the second thing to that is, does the provinces and the parks have a training system if someone comes in? Do they have a training program? Do they have internships? I know DFS nationally has many intern programs, many things they can study. So I'm very concerned that there's a total imbalance of the budget and going to people, but the actual work, why they are appointed, can't be done with the 20%. And I presume that is your problem. But we need to look at the plan, like my colleague said, that there must be a strategy how to sort this out. We just not going to talk about that. Then the second question is, why is tourism so low that the income from every national or every provincial park is so low that you foresee that they will only exist on paper? And I'm going to fall in with my colleague. What can be done? And what programs or suggestions do you have to make sure and to improve the tourism? Poor management, to me, is not an excuse. We need to start looking on consequence management. We start to look at why, if management is poor, to replace it or do training, do capacity training. There needs to be a plan for that. And if that doesn't work, there must be consequences to poor management, because poor management cannot be an excuse. So what may be suggestions that we can have to ensure that managers become skilled and competent? And then, yes, I would agree. I would love to see the report. And I don't know if it is in the report, but if it is possible, Doctor, I would really appreciate a list of every single provincial park that exists. How big they are. I know on the other presentation, some of it is there, but it's not all the fault. So we can have a list of every single area and in what state they are. Because, I mean, at this stage, I know the state is bad, but I don't know really what the state is. So that would be great, you know. So many staff members, so many animals. These animals don't get food, these don't get water. The real state of it. And I hope that is in the report. If not, if we maybe can just have all the names of all the provincial parks in every province. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Webb, Honorable Winkler.
Thank you to the chair and to the presenter. So I want to ask, am I audible? I've got a really bad connection this side.
Yes, you are loud and clear.
Yay, thank you. So yeah, very insightful presentation. And it's really nice to, you know, come into information that will help us to achieve better conservation outcomes, especially in provincial parks. I think mine is a more fundamental question. It's when we talk about conservation goals, what are we talking about exactly? What is it that we are wanting to achieve ideally? And where are the shortcomings in terms of achieving those conservation goals in provincial parks? I understand that there's, you know, obviously unsustainable financial models that are being used with 80% on salaries, but where should we ideally have the funds focused on to achieve these desired conservational outcomes? So that's just a more fundamental of understanding, you know, in terms of what are we talking about. And then similarly to Honorable Bryant, what is the main impediment that stands in the way of a public-private partnership, as we've seen in other successful cases of parks? And has this been attempted prior to this, you know, in terms of the provincial parks? And, you know, what transpired? What stood in the way of this? What were the impediments? And how can one perhaps assist to get these sort of partnerships underway? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Winkler. Honorable Singh.
No, thank you very much, Chair, and once again, compliments to everybody that's on this platform. Thank you to the doc for his presentation and for sharing his wide experience with us in terms of conservation. I think we all align ourselves, every member of this committee, align ourselves to ensuring that our fauna and flora is protected in such a way that we can also make sustainable use of it and that communities can benefit from the fauna and flora that we preserve. I think many of the issues that I wanted to raise have been raised by my colleagues, but the one issue that stands out for me is best practice. And Doc, you mentioned Madikwe and somewhere else. Now, what is it that makes those models succeed? You speak of the role of NGOs, communities, and NPCs. Now, from your experience, to what level do they have the financial resources and the human resources to be able to assist the government and the provincial parks in meeting common objectives? And perhaps that's something you can speak to. And then the other issue, which is my hobby horse, is that in terms of these parks, whether it's sand parks or provincial parks, I think what is lacking is community equity. You know, in many of the parks that you go, you'll find communities looking from up the other side of the fence, looking at the fancy Prados and Land Rovers and all these other vehicles moving inside and saying, well, there's a lot of money that's inside the park. What do we get as communities outside of these parks? So I know in KwaZulu-Natal, we did have some partnerships with the community, but to what extent from your experience do you think that sustainable partnerships with the communities in terms of equity are being practiced? Because if you can get the sustainable partnerships and ownership, then your rhino poaching and everything else, you know, will start decreasing because your neighbors and your neighboring community. I mean, we hear the president saying, we want communities to assist us in community police forum. Today, I heard somebody speaking in the debate and said, no, communities have to rise up to the occasion. So what can be done in that regard from your experience? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Singh. Honorable Weber, is that the legacy end?
No, sorry, Chair.
Okay. Dr. Mahome, about really. You are muted, Dr. Mahome. Please unmute Dr. Mahome. Chileka, may I request that you unmute Dr. Mahome, please?
The host unmuted. Yeah, I think I'm unmuted now. You can hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. It's fine. You can switch your video off.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to the first member of, I wasn't quick enough to take the name, but the question related to that some parks in the Western Cape should actually provide more access for land use other than conservation, that in his opinion, they may actually be appearing to be useless pieces of land that might only be conserving grass or other things that are not too important. I have mentioned in my presentation that when we set aside parks in South Africa, the idea of biodiversity conservation, key critical areas to conserve, was not as advanced as it is now. And that is why South African National Parks has done a sterling job by increasing the size of their protected areas, expanding parks by close to 1 million hectares between 1994 and to where we are now, because some of the parks that they had were not that important and that critical. We have seen SANParks give up a park called Falbos for exactly what the Honorable Minister was talking about, for communities to be able to access for some mining. I don't know how the mining has gone well, but where SANParks scored a lot was to have a park like Mokala given to them by government, which they were then able to expand, and it has played a critical role. I am not qualified to say what area in Western Cape is not important unless we can look at it and we can be able to comment. All that I can say, Honorable Member, is that in terms of the state efforts to conserve in South Africa, it is pathetic. We're talking about between 6 and 7% of the land that is set aside by the state, which is actually used for nature conservation. So unfortunately, because of that, it would not make sense for us to give up anything, because from the state perspective, we have done too little. Much of the land which is conserved in South Africa, close to about 20% of the landscape of South Africa, is under private hands, and those people play an important role. So I think that is as little as I can share on that one. Honorable Brian Dave asked the question, what sets Cape nature apart? I have a good cordial relationship with Dr. Howard Hendricks of SANParks, and so I don't think he will mind me using him as an example, because he is one of the leading and highly qualified people in the sector, and he has managed to stay very long in conservation. And one of the reasons why he has been able to stay very long in conservation is that he, for some reason, was not in an executive role until last year. So for the first time, Dr. Hendricks in his life should be a little bit on shaky grounds, because when you move up the ladder, that's when you may be forced to leave. By that, I mean that SANParks, when you go to many of their parks, the old technical staff that we found when we started managing SANParks, I joined SANParks in 1996. When we joined SANParks, they are still there. These are the guys that are technical. These are the guys that are highly qualified. These are the guys that know the landscape like they know the palms of their hands. I've just given you an example. Dr. Hendricks is one of them. So when you lose those type of people, that is when the situation collapses. So in SANParks and in Western Cape, we have not seen a high departure of technically capable, technically experienced staff. They are still there to a larger extent. And that is what sets them apart, Honorable Member Brian. The second one is that nature conservation is internalized. This idea of you take a bunch of school kids to a park once a year does not work. If you want our future generations to be part of conservation, they have to be exposed continuously all the time. One of the members asked about, I think it was Weber, about training programs. Those are very important if we are to retain a pool of qualified people. I have
long retired from formal conservation. The only reason why I am still in formal conservation and still involved is because it is internalized. It is in me. It is now my career. It is part of my life. I'm not able to think about doing anything else. And that is what sets this place apart. The other thing that you have said, Honorable Minister, member, that one is a fact of all the provinces that we have, Western Cape contributes by far the biggest, the largest portion to our mega diverse status. And for that, that stands apart. How can we make these places sustainable? It is through investing money from the state that we can't run away from. It is our investment, and we need to continue to make those investments, because some of these parks will not be able to make money on their own. But yes, we can't run away from the fact that we need to have sustainable tourism and private sector. I think the WOP is a good example in Western Cape, where there is a private-public partnership. In Madikwe, Madikwe Game Reserve is kept going by the fact that the private concessionaires are now actually putting money, not through the concession fees, but we are now putting money from our own revenue, and we are collecting an annual budget of about between 10 and 12 million to keep Madikwe going and those type of things. So there will have to be some South Africans that will have to say we care enough to put money in it, and that will help. There is a question about training. There is a question about the 70-30 split. There is little we can do in terms of training if people are not able to go into the parks and do the normal work that they are supposed to be doing, because they've got little money to do that. And for that, we can continue to want to appeal to the state to increase budgets. But that is not going to happen. And that is why I was suggesting that we should invite private sector, NGOs, and South Africans of goodwill that are willing to come in and help. I think it was Honorable Winkler asked about conservation goals. This is an important question, very, very important. In fact, the main reason why we are in this business is to conserve or to protect biodiversity. So that's the most important and key goal. The second one is to make sure that use of biodiversity resources is sustainable. So when we use these resources, they should at least continue to be there forever and ever. And that is where we cannot undermine technically trained people who will help us have a semblance of what we mean by sustainability. And then the third goal that you were asking about, Honorable Minister, a member, and I'm certain you do know about this, is that where there is a possibility of sharing benefits, the IUCN argues that such benefit sharing should be equitable and to some extent. And there are areas that we can talk about that would make sense to that. I think that answers that. Then there was the question from Honorable Singh, what makes the model succeed? In Sandparks, when we were working on how to make Sandparks sustainable, we had McKinsey and Company come in and help us. And one of the things that is keeping Sandparks going, and Howard Hendricks is here, and he can correct me if my figures are wrong, but at the time when I was with Sandparks, Kruger National Park alone was contributing about 70% of the income that Sandparks was contributing. But in the whole portfolio of about 20 parks that Sandparks has, about 5 or 6 are milk cows. The rest are not. About 5 or 6 are milk cows. And one of the things that helped us in terms of a best practice was manage the milk cows well, so that you are getting enough milk out of
them to feed the lambs and the calves in other parks that are not doing well. So basically, manage the whole thing as if it is one portfolio. I think one of the most important advices that we got was that the randavels in Kruger do work, whether we like it or not, they do work. Pete Pompies and the Van der Merwes and the Smiths and whoever, they have internalized visiting the parks every year. People in St. Parks will tell you that the parks are booked almost a year in advance. We don't see that from our African members of the country in terms of citizenry. But we were advised that those people that are patronizing our parks, that are making them work, we should make sure that we manage these randavels very well so that people always are interested in going there. And you will be surprised. You go to these randavels, the sheets are not necessarily the best, but the accommodation is neat and tidy. And that's what people are looking for. When they go to the ablutions in Skukuza, they are neat, they are clean. That's what people are looking for. So there is about roughly that in terms of best practice. In terms of best practice, we have seen the concessions that St. Parks has. Many of them, in terms of what they have learned from Northwest Park, have actually surpassed the performance of Northwest Park. St. Parks collects far more revenue from their concessions, few concessions than they have. And in Madikwe, for example, we've got about 32 lodges, and they don't contribute as much as St. Parks have. So in terms of best practice, we must continue to refine the model of bringing in income. And I think somewhere St. Parks has been able to crack the code. The last thing about why Western Cape works to a great extent. I mean, you look at Table Mountain, you look at the budget from the metropolitan of Cape Town itself. They are contributing yearly, if they still are doing that, Howard will be able to correct me if I'm wrong, to what the management of Table Mountain, because they have realized that Table Mountain alone contributes substantially to the economy of the Western Cape. And until we realize that these parks are contributing substantially to the economy, we will not invest. But when we realize that they do, we will make the investment. Honorable Chair, I think the last question was, are there community models that work in terms of community equity? I'm afraid, Honorable Singh, we don't have good examples of this in South Africa. Maybe Howard Hendricks may want to talk a little bit about Rachtersveld, if it could be one of the key areas that where something works. But I have already explained that the reason why we don't have good examples of community participation in our parks is because of our history, that people are divorced from the landscape in space. So you've got communities here and you've got parks there, unlike in other areas where people in Namibia and elsewhere in Botswana, where when you go to Kasani, elephants are walking around Kasani, Tau, they cross, the warthogs cross. So we don't have that here in South Africa, and it is always a difficulty, I think, to make such models work. Chair, I think that's about it. If I've left something out, I apologize.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much, Dr. Mahome. Honorable members, Dr. Mahome, how do we get it?
The presentation is with the parliamentary secretary. I've sent it already.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure it must have been shared on the group.
And I can send the full research work done by Endangered Wildlife Trust and WESA.
Yeah, please share it with Tileka, who will share it with the members.
Got it.
Honourable members, are there follow-ups maybe before we go to the next presentation? Before that, you kept referring to Howard Hendricks. Howard Hendricks, are there maybe additions or probably subtractions you want to make?
No subtractions. Chair, maybe just to add good observation as to what sets Cape Nature apart, and I suppose many of the other successful conservation areas, is the fact that there are units, or there's a particular function within these entities that, in my view, provide strategic leadership in conservation, not just through scientific information, but also the technical guidance, but also the policy inputs or services on which decisions are ultimately being made. And I think that is it's a key point summarized in one sentence, but there's a lot unfolding in that particular statement. And what is important to note is that, in my view, there are probably three key areas that makes them successful. And that is that they've been able to balance their conservation needs with their tourism needs. And you will also note this in Cape Nature as well. It may not be to the extent or impact as it is maybe in South African National Parks, but they share commonality in terms of the principles that they apply. And then secondly, what is also important is what you have to manage it effectively and efficiently. And in both cases, there's a tool called the MET, which is essentially managing the effectiveness of those protected areas. And because they have a system like that, entities are able to measure how effective their conservation actions are. And I think the third one is critically important. It is to not just sensibly grow, but also to nurture the science function that informs those decision making. And I think that those are very key important points. And as much as we are doing it within Sand Parks, but I also know that these entities pay a very keen eye. They scan the horizon for emerging conservation issues. And what that means is that these entities are able to keep an eye on conservation issues that could potentially become a threat if they're not being attended to. And I think these are kind of, in my view, what sets conservation entities apart as to when they're being successful or whether they're rather struggling. And you would also notice that in terms of Dr. Mahome's information, the data that he provided, whether those are the challenges that he identified, whether it was the opportunities, they all relate essentially to sound corporate governance right on top, whereas your conservation management challenges are at the bottom, which is in reality the complete opposite as to what the World Forum on risk, conservation risk, are referring to. Because if conservation entities are very much in tune towards success or keeping an eye on those threats on the horizon, they will all realize that things like, for example, climate change, things like, for example, polluted rivers or water for that matter, that those are issues that are, if not being paying attention to those things, that could really undermine conservation efforts. And I think what the provincial nature reserves are facing with at this point in time are immediate challenges. And whilst those immediate challenges are important from a corporate governance point of view, I think equally important it's to be looking at what are those conservation issues that, if not being attended today, may become issues for the future. And there are many tools that conservation entities can use. For an example, a conservation development framework that really tries to balance conservation with, for an example, tourism. And these are well-tested methods and methodologies that many conservation entities can benefit from in achieving greater success. Chair, I will leave it there just as a sort of observation from my point and just an additional comment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hendricks. Okay, can we then move to the Cape Leopard Trust without chowing too much of your time? Dr. Williams, are you ready for us?
Sorry, good evening, Honourable Chair Modise, and also Honourable Members, Conservation Representatives, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Helen Turnbull, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Cape Leopard Trust. I'm going to introduce Dr. Katie Williams this evening. I'd like to also just congratulate Dr. Mahomi and Dr. Ian Little for preparing such an insightful presentation for us, and also for Howard Hendricks touching on things that NGOs can do that actually raise awareness of threats to biodiversity. And that's where your presentation this evening is going to come from with the Cape Leopard Trust. We're a very small NGO in the Western Cape. Our focus is very much on research, conservation and education. And we believe that this holistic approach does bring people into conservation and connect our research very proactively with the people and communities. Without further ado, I will introduce my colleague.
One second, please. Okay. Honourable Bryant.
Thanks, sir. Thanks, Chair. I'm very, very sorry to interrupt Ms. Turnbull. I didn't mean to. I just wanted to check, is Mr. Little also going to be presenting, or is he just observing? I wasn't certain because I did see his name on the agenda.
I thought the views of Mr. Little were represented, but silence means consent, isn't it? Mr. Little, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Sorry, just one second, Ms. Turnbull. I'm sorry.
No problem. I feel that the my views have been very well represented. Dr. Mahomi did a great job presenting on our behalf in general. I would just like to really encourage everyone in the room to read the report and follow up further. So thank you for the opportunity.
I'm really sorry on Mr. Little. I also saw your name, but then it was written next to the name of Mr. Mahomi. So I thought, well, I was correct. Your views are sacrosanctly represented. Ms. Turnbull, we really apologize again. Please proceed.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Absolutely. Okay, so I'm going to introduce my learned colleague, Dr. Katie Williams from the Cape Leopard Trust. She's our Research and Conservation Director. And she's going to speak about an invisible and widespread threat to South Africa's biodiversity, which is the illegal use of snares to catch wildlife, which is causing a biodiversity crisis. Katie.
Good evening, everyone. Just please bear with me a moment while I get the screen to share. I'm struggling, I'm afraid.
Chilis, can you help there? Chile, are we winning? Are we able to assist Katie?
Apologies, everyone. Not sure why it is struggling today.
Danza, are you here?
Yes, Chair, I'm here.
Sorry, Chair. Speaking to me.
Are you able to assist Ms. Williams in terms of connection? There we go.
It's coming. Okay, can you all see my screen okay? Was that not appropriate?
Yes, we can, Katie.
Okay, thank you. Apologies for the delay there, everybody. Okay, so good evening, honourable members and ladies and gentlemen. South Africa is home to a wide variety of animal and plant life. Visitors come to our country from all over the world to enjoy the natural beauty. Our natural resources are a draw card for investment and business. Tourism is contributing significantly to South Africa's GDP, with travel and tourism contributing $168 billion to GDP in 2022 and more in 2023. However, there's a growing threat to our wildlife and tourism industry, and this is illegal snaring. So snaring is a basic but common hunting method. Essentially, a simple noose is created from a strong material, such as wire, cable, or rope, and then it's affixed to an anchor point, which is placed on a game trail or a fence line, essentially anywhere where an animal is moving. Snares are extremely easy to set up, and one person can set a multitude of snares in a very short time, but they're very difficult to see by the untrained eye. As an animal passes through, the snare will tighten around the animal's neck, abdomen, or foot, and essentially it will trap them. And as the animal tries to pull to get away, the snare tightens more and more, making escape extremely difficult and often leading to a slow and painful death from injury, starvation, or dehydration. Snarers will often only return to check their traps after extended periods, and sometimes they don't return at all, leaving large numbers of animals to waste away in snares. Stronger animals like leopards are sometimes able to pull away from the anchor point, but they can lose limbs when they do this, and the snares can also remain embedded in their bodies after they escape, which leads to infection or impacts on their movement or hunting abilities. Snaring is indiscriminate, cruel, and an unsustainable use of our natural resources. In South Africa, hunting a wild animal using snares is prohibited under Nature Conservation Ordinance 19 of 1974, specifically Section 29D, yet it's still happening. Often it's challenging to gather evidence to convict snarers, and the consequences that are administered are often too mild to deter reoffences. Snaring needs to be seriously addressed, and resources need to be invested into supporting provincial nature conservation authorities, law enforcement, and equipping judicial officials. So why are snares set? Our studies show us that bushmeat is often associated with socioeconomic factors such as poverty, low levels of formal education, unemployment, and food insecurity. Bushmeat can add variety and protein to households with limited incomes. A study that was led by the Cape Leopard Trust in the Western Cape found that the majority of snarers were doing this practice to supplement their protein or also due to convenience as well, with resources and materials to build snares being freely available. There's also little consequences for this activity, which makes the returns often greater than the risk. And snaring is now revealing itself to increasingly be a commercial practice. In some areas, bushmeat is considered a delicacy,
and is being preferred over domestic meats due to the flavour, due to cheaper prices and challenges of accessing domestic meat. Hunting with packs of dogs or for sport is also becoming more commonplace and is allegedly also happening on government-owned land. South Africa is not facing this challenge alone. Snares are spurring a global wildlife extinction crisis. We've handpicked a few little examples from across our continent. So up in Uganda, a study up in Murchison Falls National Park found 674 snares which were removed in a four-month period. Many of these, about 60% of these that had animals in, were left to rot. So these were animals that were wasted in the snares. And this trend of having wasted animals within snares has also been found in Zimbabwe. In Savi Valley Conservancy, a study showed over 1,400 animals were left rotting and wasting in snares in a four-year period. Much closer to home, if you look at Kruger National Park, recent statistics revealed that 14,000 snares were removed from Kruger between 2020 and 2022. And last year, 415 animals were killed by snares within the park. The photo featured is an African wild dog, an animal that's listed on the IUCN Red List as endangered. The Endangered Wildlife Trust recorded 70 wild dog events between 2021 and 2023 in the Greater Kruger. 55 snares were removed from the dogs and 14 wild dogs were killed in snares. If you consider that there are only 280 wild dogs in Kruger National Park, this means that one in every four wild dogs have been caught in snares in the past 3 years. If you look outside of our protected areas, the situation is equally daunting. In the Western Cape, 671 snares were found on agricultural properties during snare patrols between 2019 and 2020. The occurrence of snares is increasing since COVID, and there's so much that we don't know about this illegal practice and its full impact on nature. Where we work in the Greater Cape Floristic Region of the Western Cape, this is one of the hotspots for biodiversity, and it contains thousands of plant species that are found nowhere else in the world. The human population in the Western Cape has grown by over 1.6 million people in the past 11 years. And this increasing population brings with it urban expansion, increased agricultural land use, and a spike in anthropogenic activity on wild spaces. On a positive note, the Cape Leopard Trust camera traps reveal a rich and diverse mammal guild that we find within the Western Cape. But data is also showing that snaring is ravishing much of the wildlife that we rely on for our economy and for preserving human health as well. The Cape Leopard Trust research shows that the snares that are set in the Boland area of the Western Cape are primarily set for small antelope and porcupine. And our studies looking at the diet of leopards in the same area reveal that these species make up a very large percentage of the leopard's diet. And this indicates that the loss of small antelope and porcupine in snares is going to have a major issue on leopards' prey availability and their behavior and their ability to thrive and survive in these areas. Through our research as well, we've determined that snaring often increases in certain spaces, so closer to protected areas where there's more wildlife, closer to rivers, and at slightly higher elevations. These are the spaces where leopards are often utilizing. And we did interviews with people who were admitting to snaring, and it was said that people were more likely to set snares if they said they didn't know it was illegal and if there were no consequences, no punitive measures that were being put in place on the properties where they work. The Cape Leopard Trust camera traps also photograph leopards across the Western Cape. This is the last remaining Big Five member in this province that can roam free here. And we use our camera trap images to estimate density of leopards and to monitor the populations. This majestic male shown here is BM27. He's also known as Diego. And as a territorial male, Diego has been observed for about 10 years around the Cockleburg biosphere. However, last December, Diego's carcass was found, and he has been caught by a snare, and his body was found at the bottom of Sir Lowry's Fast, not far from the Strand and Somerset West, where people are sort of moving into his spaces and setting snares. This death of Diego is one of 8 leopards that the Cape Leopard Trust is aware of that have been caught in snares in the Western Cape between 2012 and 2023. We have very little doubt that there are many more leopards that have also succumbed to this hunting method as bycatch. And I think it's important to say that considering that leopards in the Western Cape occur at a much lower density than leopards in other parts of South Africa, each leopard that is caught in a snare and each leopard that is dying to this, this method is actually a serious and sharp blow to leopard survival in this region. We really can't afford for this to be happening. In response to the alarming number of snares that have been found in the Western Cape and the clear need for a collaborative response to snaring to try and get to animals that are caught as quickly and as efficiently as possible, we created an initiative called Snare Free. It was a joint initiative between 5 different partner organizations, the Cape Leopard Trust, Cape Nature, Cockleburg Biosphere, Wildlife Forensic Academy, and the Cape of Good Hope SPCA. And the initiative was launched last August thanks to financial support from the International Fund for Animal Welfare. And it really gives us a coordinated response for snared wildlife in the Western Cape and helps us to improve training, data collection, and awareness to combat the prevalence of snares in the province. As part of Snare Free, a core component of it is the Western Cape Snare Response Plan. And this response plan is a coordinated system to help animals that are caught in snares. The founding organizations came together to use their expertise to develop a rigorous protocol that aligns with the policies of the organizations and considers the legal stipulations and bylaws to ensure animal welfare and human safety are prioritized. Just to quickly explain how the Snare Free initiative is working and the response plan, we have a hotline, a 24/7 hotline number that's active now within the Western Cape. And members of the public can phone to report live animals that are caught in snares. As soon as a call is received, then the hotline handler is able to work through a detailed communication structure to get a veterinarian and the relevant authority to the site as quickly as possible to assist the animal. And from that, we're able to collect data on the situation, and we're also able to provide follow-up support and training for the landowners that have experienced snaring to try and prevent it from happening again in future. Snarefree has also created a number of resources that are available to landowners and conservation officials, and we offer training to people in the public, but also organizations on how to conduct snare controls, how to spot snares, how to safely remove them, and how to communicate about snaring. And this initiative is all part of our goal to bring snaring, which is an invisible and often overlooked problem, out into the open to help everyone become more aware of snaring and the challenges that it faces, and to encourage people to become active players in addressing this biodiversity crisis together. In terms of snaring solutions that we can consider, we really need to take a multifaceted and holistic approach, which includes research, conservation, and education to properly tackle this. Research on snaring is sorely lacking, and it's absolutely vital to be able to understand the problem and predict snaring hotspots within the landscape. And we can also use data to help us work out the best way to combat the problem in different areas, because there is really no one-size-fits-all conservation solution to it. It really has to be tailored to different areas and different people who are working in the landscape. Conservation initiatives are also sorely needed. In the short term, we really need to prioritize implementing solutions that can remove snares from the landscape, can effectively respond to live animals caught in snares, and can encourage efficient policing and patrolling for snares. And this absolutely must be done now before we lose our diverse and world-renowned wildlife species completely. in the longer term, we actually have to also be thinking about addressing the drivers of snaring and working to support other areas in need. Education is also a vital strategy as part of trying to reduce snaring, and we need to spread awareness about snaring, and we really need to upskill and educate communities to help improve their livelihoods. And it's also essential to improve legislation and mitigation around snaring. And it's important to say that right now we are sitting at a crossroads, so essentially we can actually change this trend and we can protect wildlife if we act now. Because we have a choice. Are we going to stand and watch our biodiversity and the wildlife economy continue to drastically decline due to this cruel and growing threat that is lurking in our natural spaces? Last year, actually, the critically endangered Indo-Chinese leopard was deemed functionally extinct due to rampant snaring in Southeast Asia. And I think we need to ask ourselves, do we want our leopards, our wild dogs, our buffaloes, our antelopes to face the same fate? Are we willing to actually risk our valuable tourism revenue and all of the livelihoods that tourism supports? Or can South Africa actually stand up and can we be a leader in combating snaring? Because now is definitely the time. So we're standing before you, asking you to come and sort of come together with us, because we have a chance to do something before it's too late. Essentially, with Snare Free, it was a collaboration of organizations that took action and came together to do something in the Western Cape. But Snare Free is a privately funded operation and initiative that's only got funding until October this year. And it's only applying to one province, and it only has limited resources. We need to think about what is the future of Snare Free and all of our wildlife if we let snaring continue unchecked, and what is government willing to contribute to this problem and to addressing it as soon as possible. We are seeking your support to build a multi-layered solution that's going to really help us to address this complex problem. We need a national strategy that's led by a national forum as the first step. This problem is far too large to deal with independently, and we need to unite the stakeholders from a diversity of different backgrounds to explore the ways forward together and create nature-based livelihood solutions that can help to combat this. And we really need to draw on our national sense of pride in conserving nature to ensure that we do have wildlife left to protect and wildlife left to show our tourists when they come. In terms of increasing knowledge sharing and awareness, this is something the Cape Leopard Trust is trying to do and has been very much reached out to. We've received many requests for snaring support from other conservation organizations, both across South Africa and other Southern African countries. We need improved knowledge sharing between stakeholders so we can learn from each other and support each other. And the Cape Leopard Trust and our partner organizations are aiming to host a national snare mitigation symposium later this year, and we seek government support to be able to achieve this. But sharing information can't just be amongst conservation organizations and officials. We really need to boost awareness across the whole sector of society so it's no longer an issue that can be ignored or downgraded. And data collection needs to be improved as well. So at the moment, there are massive gaps in knowledge as to where snaring is happening, what the drivers of snaring are, and we really need to have a big push to improve data collection across the country and to create a central point to collate information so that we can fully understand the problem and make informed and science-based decisions on how to combat it. We need to also improve resources for provincial nature conservation bodies, conservation organizations, and landowners to help them remove snares, to help them respond to animals that are caught in snares, to build strategies that are going to mitigate snaring, and to collect evidence that can prosecute for this legal activity. Our snare-free hotline can only support animals caught in snares in the Western Cape. Should we perhaps consider a national hotline given the gravity of this situation? And can we work on rolling that out together if so? We really feel that we need to work together now to make a collective stand against snaring before the wildlife that we have is decimated, before we have no wildlife economy left,
and we have a tragic loss of biodiversity, challenged agricultural productivity, and compromised food security. We are also aware that if we don't act now, we are going to reduce our tourism and we're going to have a dramatic GDP decline. So considering our 30 by 2030 goals, we really are calling on you and your help to help us to avoid a deadly domino effect in terms of the snaring situation that is unfolding in front of us. And I think as was seen at the sort of end of the last talk, it was talking about efficient conservation and mentioned how one of the things that can be a conservation success is to see when a problem is coming and to react before it becomes something we can't deal with. We don't want to be looking back and wishing we'd done something. Now is the time to wake up, and we really need to do this together. So thank you so much for your time. We'd love for you to look at the Snare Free website. There's a lot of information on there, and learn a bit about what we're doing in the Western Cape. And we'd love to discuss what we can all do together about this serious issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I see Ms. Turnbull is switching on her camera. This is Ms. Turnbull.
Yes, thank you. I was just going to be available to assist with Katie with questions if there are any. We hope there's going to be a lot of constructive discussion.
Great. Honourable members, I invite you to engage the presentation from Cape Leopard Trust. Honourable Winkler, you'll be the first. Honourable Bryant, you'll be the second. Honourable Singh, you'll be the third, in that order.
All right. Thank you, Chair, and thank you to Dr. Williams and the Cape Leopard Trust. You know, I have been fortunate enough to engage with the Cape Leopard Trust prior to this, and they really are doing some incredible work to, I think, educate people on the huge threat that snaring poses to our biodiversity conservation. I know that in the National Park, we had a 400% increase in snaring for the last couple of years. And this is something that is not often mentioned in departmental report backs, especially, you know, in terms of such a mounting problem. See attention that Dr. Katie has outlined this evening. And so I think that, thank you so much for bringing this, you know, to our attention, and the amazing work you're doing around this. And I really hope we can find a way to assist you going forward. But I'll hand over to my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Winkler. Honorable Brian.
Thanks very much, Chair. And Chair, I just apologize if I do get cut off halfway through. I'm almost done with my load shedding schedule. So either way, I'll be able to plug back in again at 8. But if I do cut off, that's the reason. Just thank you, Katie and Helen, for that presentation. I think, as Hannah has really mentioned, you know, really fantastic work that's being undertaken by you and your team. And, you know, it's quite evident that you're filling a gap that is quite gaping at present. A couple of questions. Just firstly, in terms of the snaring hotspots that you have identified, particularly obviously in the Western Cape, are you working with authorities, local or otherwise, to affect prosecutions of those involved in snaring? I know it is a delicate area because often these are people from underprivileged backgrounds who are involved in snaring for sustenance, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it is still an illegal practice. Do you feel that you're getting the requisite support from the authorities in terms of affecting those prosecutions, and what are some of the challenges that you face in terms of achieving that? Then in terms of what you mentioned with improving the legislation, is there any specific piece of legislation that you would like to see amended, or you're pushing to have amended? Or do you feel that there is wholly new legislation that needs to be put in place and promulgated either by the National Assembly or potentially the provinces, or perhaps even on a local level. You know, I think one of the other challenges, obviously, is
He had warned, Honorable Brian had warned us of his predicament. I'll try and check on him privately if he can deposit some of the questions that were left. Honorable Singh.
Well, thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I just want to pick up where Honorable Brian left off, and that is, you know, I mean, you are doing great work. You are exposing these atrocities, as I might call them. You are crying out for help to legislators who are us. But what specific areas are you looking at for assistance? Now, I know that, I don't know to what extent are you involved in communities, because two of the reasons that you gave yourself from your research was, I think 85% you spoke about protein and then convenience. Now, what can be done to mitigate these needs in the communities? You know, sometimes you find people committing crime and murder and all sorts of things, and you try and figure out why. So here you seem to have a reason why this is being done, although if people want protein, et cetera, they wouldn't leave their snares there and just forget about it. So what specific interventions are you proposing? And I had the pleasure of the presentation by the Cape Leopard Trust, I think many, many years ago at Francis Gerard's house. I think he's online as well. And, you know, you're doing great work there. But I think for us, you know, the question is, what specific interventions would you like to see from our side? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. Honorable Winkler.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, the Honorable Brian is still connecting, but he did want to just add that he wants to know what is the response from Sandparks into this snaring issue, and what are they planning to do around this? Thank you.
Okay. Sandparks is here. Must have picked up that the questions of both Honorable Singh and Honorable Bryant and that addition of Honorable Winkler are inextricably interlinked. But what are the areas particularly, the specifics from us? Maybe coupled with, are there any other areas of common convergence between yourself and Sandparks? Have you had engagement with them? If yes, how far have they went? Because Sandparks is our entity. If we can, because we'll give them an opportunity to also clarify areas that they think yourself and themselves might need to work together on. But let me give you an opportunity first, and then we'll invite Sandparks.
Okay, thank you very much for all those questions. We really appreciate it. So I'll have a go at answering some of them, but if my colleague Helen would like to jump in or elaborate on any of the points, we would welcome her comments as well. So firstly, I think Honorable Bryant mentioned about working in the hotspots and working with authorities to try and affect prosecutions for snaring. So, and what are we doing in terms of that? What's our collaboration and how are we going forward with this? And what challenges do we have as well? So we are working quite closely with a number of the authorities, so with Cape Nature specifically. So they've been helping us a lot to understand the legal framework and to help us to work together towards
trying to get prosecutions in place whenever possible. We're also working with the Wildlife Forensic Academy and learning from them about how we can collect evidence better and doing training courses to try and make sure that landowners and conservation officials understand how to gain evidence when they're in the field and how important it is that they do preserve the footprints and the DNA potentially on the snares to be able to make a proper legal case if there is a snare situation happening on a property and we can work out who the person involved is. But there is significant challenges with prosecution. So one of the things that often happens is it's very hard to prove that someone is definitely setting a snare. You're really struggling sometimes to prove that it's not just somebody who's carrying wire or carrying snares out of the felt. So if they, for example, have got snares in their hand, you need to be able to prove that they have been setting them and often really try and almost couple the snaring with other charges as well. So with possession of wild species or trespassing, other different misdemeanors can be combined together. So trying to gather more holistic evidence as well. So we're trying to understand this. And as part of the snare mitigation symposium that we would like to be hosting later this year, we will be having a specific theme that is going to dive into this legal challenges and the prosecution areas in terms of building our knowledge and building everybody's knowledge on how we can go forward with this, because I think that knowledge sharing is what's really lacking, and I think we can learn so much from the other provinces and the other areas, especially areas that maybe are dealing with more endangered species or more dangerous species as well. I think that they may have more hands-on information about the prosecution and the legislation. It was also asked by Honourable Bryant about legislation and the national support that we would like. So I think, again, with our sort of our research that we've done so far, we have felt that there is some legislation in place, but it's perhaps not being taken as seriously as we would like in terms of the advocacy for it, to make sure that people are aware of it and to make sure that the authorities that can gather evidence and can take people to court for it are actually understanding the system and reacting to it properly. We do also feel that perhaps within the judicial teams, so the judges need a little bit of exposure to this as well to understand how harmful this practice is to help them make decisions within the court system as well. I'm going to stop there with that's just a few of the queries. I don't know if Helen wants to add to any of those points before I maybe move on to some of the other questions that were asked.
Yes, Katie, I'll just add that the Forensic Wildlife Academy, which is situated on the West Coast, has a mock-up courtroom because I've been working in conservation for almost 20 years now. And since working with rhino poaching, I know that it's very hard to collect evidence. And although our learned colleague, Dr. Ian Little and EWT are doing a lot of work to perhaps look at detecting snares with sniffer dogs and picking up DNA, it's still in early days. And I think despite this being a drastically big problem, actually how we're going to police it is actually only in its infancy now, and we need a lot of people to add value and help us to come to a decision how it can be policed. And that perhaps will lead on to our answers regarding legislation. I think we'll need a lot of input from Sandparks and Cape Nature about how we can effectively influence and add legislation if it's needed. But there are a lot of complex factors influencing snaring, which is a major problem. So in terms of where do we need help, I think there's quite a lot of things that can be done. We did potentially look at considering approaching Sandparks and Cape Nature to perhaps train up teams similar to the Lady Black Mambas up in Kruger, but specifically across provinces for snare detection. That's one option. But that's, again, putting a financial load on our government bodies. The Cape Leopard Trust does a lot to try and help to raise funds to enable a lot of work as much as we can. But I think if we can come together and collaboratively address these challenges, perhaps we've got more chance of pulling off a success.
Yeah, thank you, Helen. I think that national task team, if we can establish one to build a national forum, would really be the way we could start to work with organizations like SANPARC to achieve this. I also wanted to just touch on Honourable Singh's question about the communities that are involved in the snaring, and you know, the fact that people are often doing this for protein and also due to convenience as well, and what interventions can we consider to try and address this, because these are such complex issues. And I think that is what makes snaring such a difficult thing to address. It's really not an easy situation where we can just take all the snares out of the landscape. They will come back unless we go to the root of the problem and we work with communities. And we are aware of that. That's why we're really advocating for a short-term and a long-term way of thinking about this problem in terms of conservation strategies. And one thing that we've been doing is trying to really understand the communities a bit better. Last year, actually, we hosted over 100 confidential interviews that were conducted within four different communities in the Western Cape. We spoke to people who were setting snares, trying to understand a bit more about the drivers of their snaring activity, and also talking to them about their issues, so about food security that they're facing, about their cultural history as well, about whether this is connected with some of their practices that come within their culture and what are those. And then also talking to them about potential alternative livelihood solutions that they might consider to replace snaring from their daily activities. So we're starting to kind of dive into this a little bit. But what I think would be ideal is potentially areas that have been through a lot of research has been gathered that have been allocated as snaring hotspots, places where we know we are getting a lot of snaring and we are losing really important species. If we can basically target those areas and start to develop systems with the communities, so working together with the communities to build alternative income structures that they could consider, or alternative approaches, really bringing on environmental education that they can connect with and understand. Because I think what sometimes happens as well is that the snarers will set these snares because they're looking for food, but maybe they don't go and check them because you know, they move on, or because the materials are so free and cheap to get, they just set some more in another space. But what they don't think about is the aftermath. And sometimes I think people who set these snares don't actually realize that they could be catching an animal that wasn't their target species, something like a leopard that's going to walk in there and is going to suffer. And so I think if we can get communication about this problem and education about this problem to these hotspot communities and start working with them, making teams with them, and maybe doing like what Helen said, getting some of these community members to become the guys who go out and remove snares and talk to the kids about snaring. If we can have that come from within the community, then maybe we can turn some of these hotspots around and turn them into real sort of inspiration communities for other areas to replicate. So we're definitely thinking along this system of working with communities, but we really have to make sure that what we do is done very sensitively and also based on proper information as well. And I think the last comment that maybe we haven't replied to much is by Honourable Winkler about SANPARCs. I think we've touched a bit on SANPARCs. But just asking, you know, what engagement we have with SANPARCs and what we are planning to do maybe with SANPARCs, because they're obviously facing this crisis across many of their protected areas. And SANPARCs is one of the organizations that we are looking to work with as we start to build a national symposium, a snare mitigation symposium. We'd very much like to invite them to be speakers at that, to be part of the brainstorming sessions where we work out strategies for this. And we've already been engaging with SANPARCs in the Western Cape to an extent. So when we did roll out our Western Cape Snare Response Plan, we had SANPARCs come and attend some of our planning meetings for that. And they're very much informed, and their honorary rangers in the Western Cape are very informed. But nationally, we haven't had the opportunity yet to really engage with them. But that is something we would very much like to do, and we'd like to learn from them as well.
Okay. CEO, good evening.
Good evening. Good evening, Chairperson. Which CEO? Okay.
Yeah, yourself. I see that. Oh, okay. I see there are two CEOs there.
Yes, Chairperson. Good evening to yourselves and to all the honorable members present, as well as our visitors. Have been very interesting presentations we've received. The issue of snaring is one that even in the last quarter we highlighted to yourselves as the committee, as being one of the key challenges that are emerging around Kruger, and that we are scrambling to firstly understand the reasons for before we can even think of the interventions. I'd like to invite the managing executive of Kruger, Mr. Oscar Mthimkhulu, to perhaps give you a sense of where we are in the Kruger regarding this matter. But before I hand over to him as well, I'd like to indicate that we're very happy to work with yourselves, Ms. Williams and Ms. Turnbull, going forward, and we'd be very keen to engage at a national level with yourselves. I trust that it will be very easy for us to connect, and we will definitely reach out tomorrow morning. Mr. Mthimkhulu, can you please take this? Thank you. Are you still there, sir?
Yes, thank you, CEO. Good evening, Chairperson and honorable members. And Kruger situation, as indicated, I think one of the issues is the fact that we have really put effort to put resources to try and detect where the snarings are being set. But also we have improved in terms of our reporting. Hence, we have a fairly good idea in terms of where we are in terms of the amount of snaring. But the main issue in terms of us was really to really understand the drivers behind this high levels of snaring. And we have engaged communities, started from the north as early as last year towards the end of the year. We've just finished our community engagement or community dialogue last week with the communities in the south. But what we are picking up from the community point of view is what Dr. Williams has indicated and pointed out, to say part of it is subsistence kind of utilization of resources, but the issue is that how that resources is collected and utilized. So it becomes an issue, and that's what we are engaging with them. But what they are saying to us is that as much as some of it is unintentional, but there are drivers from a socio-economic point of view that are fundamental in terms of driving this kind of behavior. And what was interesting was that when we engaged with the communities, they were saying that some of the people that are involved is actually youth, as small as from 10 years up to 16 years, who are involved in this kind of activities. And part of it was saying that they also suspected that there is also syndicate behind this kind of illegal and criminality. And I think that's what we're trying to get it to dig deeper. But we also realize that this is an issue that we cannot resolve ourselves alone. We are working with NGOs such as Endangered Wildlife Trust and the others. But also, not just from a Kruger point of view, but from a greater Kruger perspective, it's something that we are already engaging at GLTFCA, which is the Greater Limpopo Transfrontier Conservation Area, because we've realized that it doesn't only end around the Kruger boundary, but it also extends to other areas and private reserves and cuts across provinces. And that's what we are trying to put together to say, from a GLTFCA point of view, what is our position? How are we going to deal with this issue? But we need to look at the drivers behind this. But also, when you're dealing with people who are relying on such resource as a life, you also need to look at what alternatives can we try and mobilize so that we can move people away from this kind of behavior? So, Chair, in a nutshell, it's something that we believe would require collective effort. It will require more cooperative arrangement for us to be able to deal with these issues. But there are fundamental issues from a social economic point of view. They will also have to deal with and come up with alternatives, because otherwise we are not going to be able to resolve these issues, bearing in mind that this issue of illegal use of resources, because of our legal historical legacy issues, they have been associated with the parks, but it's just the level that where this thing is that we now try to manage. But this would require a collective effort for us to be able to take the process forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Mthimkhulu. Ms. Turnbull and Ms. Williams, I suspect that we might have just got you a deal. Honorable Winkler.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to CEO Sello and the other gentlemen. My question is, so we know about the extent of snaring to some degree, at least in Kruger National Park, because of the increased sort of, tracking and monitoring at different hotspots. But do we have any idea on how prevalent and how significant this is in other parks across South Africa? And to the extent to which this is, a significant problem that needs to urgently be addressed. And speaking about the community, this really goes to the heart of the issue is, how do we get by enough communities to really see conservation and these parks as protected and to be revered in a way? And it's hard when communities don't feel that they benefit from our national parks. And so there was an instance, I know, Isimangaliso, where they also had many instances of, I think, poaching and snaring, and the community was up in arms about the development in the park and how they weren't getting any buy-in. And I think that Isimangaliso was able to manage a kind of pilot project where they did engage with the community, and eventually they were able to get the community's buy-in, and now there's a successful story around that. And I wonder if that's not something that we can learn from the other entity as well, when looking at how do we, approach this issue of community buy-in and allowing communities to also benefit from these parks, for example. If that's perhaps something that Sandbox has considered, or if they are aware of what's happened at Isimangaliso and how the parks work with the communities, and also, again, as I said, the extent of this and the urgency with which we're going to deal with it. Thank you.
Okay. Any last words from yourself, Metin Bulim Williams?
In terms of the issue across the other parks, I hope some parks might have some other data that they can share with us on that statement. In terms of the nature conservation authorities, I know that many of the authorities across the country have recorded issues with leopards being caught as bycatch at significant numbers in places like Mpumalanga and Northwest Province, and there's been quite a few publications on that. So I can get those together and give you a bit more of an overview of the situation in terms of large free-roaming leopards and how they're getting caught across other provinces in and out of parks that have been reported to authorities. But I'm not extremely clued up on what's happening in some of the other park situations and how many snares have been acquired in those locations. But perhaps the SAM Parks staff might be able to shed some light on that further.
Chair Modise, if I can also add to Katie's comments that it's important
we get... Yes, Ms. Turnbull, please proceed.
Yeah, it's important that we get our children involved. It's by
promoting environmental education. There are some shining lights up close to Kruger, like Wildshots Outreach, for instance, some NGOs that bring children into the Kruger to see wildlife for the first time. I think there is great potential to approach it from both sides. It's looking at livelihood development and perhaps assisting or enabling the community to be part of that law enforcement method, but also to bring children closer to wildlife and nature so they understand and get to love it. And that's the only way they're going to protect it.
Okay, how do we facilitate the meeting, CEO, between yourself and Cape Leopard Trust, CEO of SANParks? Should we leave that to you between yourself and the secretary of the committee?
Yes, Chair, please do. We will be in touch within the next day. Yes.
Wonderful. Let's then, there's consensus that we need to protect our biodiversity, and there's an agreement that we must use every other little resource at our disposal to preserve whatever is left of our biodiversity. Let me take this opportunity and thank all of you for joining us in tonight's meeting. I am sure honorable members are extremely tired. We are all from Parliament since 10 o'clock until 5:30 this afternoon. But these engagements shall continue. You will engage through the Secretary of the Committee, Ms. Chilaka Madubela, who will facilitate a meeting between yourselves and SANParks. And ourselves are forever available. Our door is permanently open. But let me take this opportunity to thank everybody else who participated in tonight's meeting, including those who are broadcasting. I'm receiving some calls that we are on TV. Tell the ladies to smile so you have an opportunity to... Right. Honorable members, that brings us all to the end of the meeting. Thanks to the team of South African National Parks and everybody who came. Have a great evening.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Recording
you
stopped.
Good night.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.